We're going to take a short break for one of our sponsors. I haven't tried this one, but it looks well worth checking out if weight loss has been an ongoing challenge for you. Robody pairs medication options with diet and exercise modifications to achieve your desired goal. Before being prescribed any medication, patients complete an online medical visit, lab test, and more to see if you're right for their program. You can sign up online, which means no scheduling a doctor's appointment, no commute to the doctor's office, and no waiting rooms. Their data shows that average weight loss is 15 to 20% in 1 year with healthy lifestyle changes. BMI and other eligibility criteria apply. Go to ro.co/untangle. Sign up today and you'll pay just $99 a month for your first month and $145 a month after that. Medication costs are separate. That's ro.co/untangle. Now, back to our show. We're taking a short break to tell you a little bit about the 10% Happier podcast hosted by my friend Dan Harris. It has one guiding philosophy. Happiness is a skill you can learn, so why not master it? I recently talked to him on our show about what has changed since he wrote 10% Happier 10 years ago. A lot. Dan was once a fidgety, skeptical journalist, but after suffering a panic attack on national television, he decided to change his life. This journey led him to learn everything he could about the human psyche. Now he's on a quest to help others achieve peace and happiness. Each week, he talks to top scientists, meditation teachers, and even the odd celebrity, exploring topics like productivity, anxiety, enlightenment, psychedelics, and relationships. He's funny. He's smart. He's one of the best interviewers I know. Think of listening to 10% Happier as a workout for your mind. The 10% Happier podcast is available wherever you listen to podcasts. Welcome to Untangle, the podcast from Five Star App Meditation Studio. I'm Patricia Karpus, co-founder of Meditation Studio and your host on Untangle, along with my co-host every other week, Ariel Garten, co-founder of Muse, the brain sensing headband. Join us each week as we introduce you to authors, experts, and thought leaders who share their stories on how meditation and mindfulness practices have the power to change our lives. Today, we have two pretty amazing guests. You'll meet Catherine Sellery and Annalise Richman. These two women are trying to shake up the current mental health crisis we're experiencing in this country. Catherine is a parenting coach and has trained thousands over the years in conscious and effective parenting. Annalise designs and facilitates mindfulness and meditation-based programs for wellness and personal development. She's also the founder of the Sky Campus Happiness Program, where she's worked with MIT, Yale, Google, and many others. They share why mental health awareness and well-being tools are so important for our kids, college students, and adults. And the reasons are pretty darn compelling. You'll hear how staggering the depression, anxiety, and suicide statistics are in this country. They're creating the inaugural Mental Health and Fitness Summit, hoping to disrupt America's mental health crisis by bringing together innovative health, education, policy, and business leaders to share in this discussion. The summit is in Denver, July 23rd and 24th, and you can pick up tickets at summit.americameditates.org. I agree with them. It's going to take all of us working collaboratively to help people optimize their mental health and live their lives more fully and more happily. Again, check out their website at summit.americameditates.org. Now, here's Annalise and Catherine. Catherine and Annalise, I am so happy to have you both on Untangle today.
It's so great to be here, Patricia. Thank you so much for inviting us.
Welcome to you both. This is a really important topic we're talking about today related to mental health and some of the challenges that we're facing overall. And I know you two are super interested in also major advocates and trying to impact change in this area. And I want to start by letting our audience know how serious this issue is. And I think, Catherine, you were going to share some statistics that are pretty powerful.
Suicide is the 10th leading cause of death in the United States, and it's the second leading cause of death for people aged 10 to 34.
Wow.
Second leading cause of death for people aged 10 to 34.
That's crazy.
Yeah.
46% of our homeless population live with severe mental illness or substance abuse disorders. Every day, an estimated 18 to 22 veterans die by suicide. The United States has the highest rate of deaths from mental illness. One in five American adults and children aged between 13 and 18, live with a mental health condition today, and only half of them seek professional help.
What are you seeing as the leading sort of causes of suicide? And I also want to understand about adults in general, because we're talking about these different populations where we know that there's a lot of trauma, especially with veterans. But what about the statistics are pretty staggering for depression and anxiety among adults 18 and older.
Yeah, I mean, 70% of youth today identify anxiety and depression as the top problem that's impacting them. 70%. If you look at just the landscape, we have Kate Spade, Anthony Bourdain. I mean, the list of what we would call the rich and famous that are committing suicide as well just goes to show you that it's actually not a socioeconomic issue. We can see the breadth of this because it extends into the populations in society that we would think would so-called be the happiest if it had to do with success and financial well-being.
Right.
But it's not.
So what do you see as some of the causes today of depression, anxiety? Suicide is an outcome probably of depression and anxiety and other impacts. What do you see as what's fueling this today?
I think a lot of it is fueled by a sense of belongingness that's absent in many landscapes. Mm-hmm. And that sense of belongingness is so, so important that if we feel isolated and alone, it's very difficult for us. And so our need for belongingness is as important as our need for sleep and food. It's right there at the bottom baseline of Maslow's hierarchy of needs. We can't really survive in isolation in terms of a daily experience is devastating to our sense of happiness, connection, well-being. That I think that's probably one of the biggest issues that we're facing right now.
Would you agree with that, Annalie?
Yes. There's been a lot of recent studies on the sense of connection in us, the social connection, and its relationship with our physical health. So there was one study that showed that a lack of a sense of connection in life is a bigger predictor of disease and early death than all the main killers in the U.S., smoking, heart disease, and high blood pressure. Then a sense of disconnection was a higher predictor of early death and disease than what we consider the big killers.
Wow, it's staggering. What I don't understand is, when you talk about the statistics for high school students and even college students, they're on campuses where there are so many like-minded people. And why is there such a strong sense of disconnection or a lack of belonging among these populations?
It's interesting. On university campuses, in the last 2 years, anxiety has just surpassed depression as the leading mental health disorder. 41.6% of our U.S. college students have anxiety. This is almost half the population, which to me is insane. About 36% have depression. And I'll just tell you my personal experience. I run a program called SKY, the Campus Happiness Program, on 47 university campuses. And I was teaching at MIT 2 years back. I was talking about how social connectedness is one of the most important factors for ourselves to lead happy lives. And they said, oh, Annalie, campuses try to do it. On MIT, there's a hello walk. And they said, but on that walk, nobody says hello. Everybody just looks down at their phones and doesn't even notice each other. So even though there's an attempt to make people more social, it's not happening. I think it's because of anxiety and depression, and it's also because of the screen time.
It's hard to understand. I'm trying to make sense of, let's take a college student who is dealing with anxiety. Is it the anxiety that prevents them from wanting to engage in things that will make them feel more connected. Like, so even when you are with all of these other people, you can't really connect with them and you don't really feel like you belong because you have either social anxiety or some other kind of anxiety.
Brené Brown talks about the distinction between fitting in and belonging. And I don't know if you've heard her talk about this, but it's so powerful. Fitting in is actually a very delicate, because you know at a deep level, you could very easily not fit in. Like your capacity to fit into that group is contingent upon a certain type of presentation or way of being. And if you don't continue to follow in that track, you could be isolated from that group. Whereas that deep sense of belonging is, I love you warts and all. Like you belong here no matter how much of you I see that I may not like. I'm going to take you just as you are. That kind of deep sense of belonging is actually rare.
Yeah,
I think a lot of us have grown up in situations where we have a best friend and we know with them, they're going to just take us. They're going to take us just the way we are. And hopefully we have families that'll do that. Like my dad used to say, honey, I love you warts and all. I think that was a blessing. I don't know if all families have that I love you warts and all. A lot of parents put a lot of pressure on their kids. I love you if you have a 4.0. I love you if you get into an Ivy League.
I think it's also a chicken or egg thing. If you already have anxiety and you enter into university, you don't want to go to the events for social connection. You don't reach out. You get more and more isolated. I was teaching at a medical school and they told me their main problem is there's so much pressure to achieve and study that 2 to 3 months into the first year of med school, they get socially isolated. They forget they have a family at home. They said they start forgetting to call home. And this is a big detriment to their mental health. But I also think it works the other way around. Even if you don't have anxiety, if you stop connecting socially because it doesn't seem important to your success in life, there's so much pressure in our society today to succeed that I've seen students starting to regard social connection and being with friends and hanging out as a not good use of their time because it's not making them climb the ladder. I literally had my Yale students tell me that. Like, they told me, I don't want to connect because it's a waste of time. And they don't realize that that time is so well spent. It's giving them like social connection, which increases your well-being on a physical, mental, emotional, and even spiritual level.
That competitiveness. I have a daughter who is entering her third year at USC in Los Angeles, University of Southern California. And for her freshman class, there were 57,000 applications for 3,500 spots. Wow. Think about it. The number of kids who didn't get in, right? 50-something thousand applicants who didn't get in. And of those, they told us some huge percentage were 4.0s. Huge percentage had perfect SAT scores. It's not like these kids aren't unbelievably talented. It's the competition.
I think the social pressure to achieve has gone up and up and up over the past few decades. And at the same time, I feel like family dinners have disintegrated. So even the connectedness time spent inside of your own family has been greatly reduced. And the pressure to achieve has gotten ridiculous. Yeah. And at the same time, people don't learn enough that your productivity is related to your happiness. So everyone is so intensely focused on being productive and pushing their happiness and their well-being aside that this epidemic has come up.
I watched one of the videos of Annalise teaching at one of the colleges in the SKY program. I guess that might have been at Yale. And one of the things she was talking about was trying to like get the students focused on their well-being and asking them what are the things that stress them out the most? Everybody said everything, basically work, relationships, health, kids, school, money, bills, caretaking. And then what are the effects of stress? No sleep, getting sick, having to take medication, frustration, eating, bad memories, sleepiness. It's also complicated. And that's why I think that the program, you know, I almost look at the SKY program as like a well-being toolbox for people. I want to hear a little bit more about like what is that toolbox? And then let's talk about how you're trying to get that out there in a much even bigger way.
We've seen that we need a multi-pronged approach in the SKY program. So we do use evidence-based meditation, but we realize we don't want to call it a meditation program. We want to call it a happiness program, which is why we call it SKY, and for campuses, it's the Campus Happiness Program, because we want to address happiness and well-being from four different angles. So of course, the basis is evidence-based breath work and meditation. The breath work, breathing techniques, and even the SKY meditation technique itself uses rhythmic breathing patterns to get rid of anxiety, to relieve depression, and get one into a state of deep meditation. So we find that breath work combined with meditation is very important, but that's just one aspect. The second aspect is exercises and experiences in social connection, so that the students actually realize social connection is making them happier, and it's also making them more effective in life. And the third thing we focus on is leadership and service, because an attitude of service has been shown in so much current research to make you happier. It gives you a sense of worth. It gives you a sense of purpose in life. And when you have a sense of purpose, you're happy and you feel that you deserve to live on this planet. And the fourth approach we take is really through the intellect. I would call it emotional intelligence training. So putting emphasis on empathy and respect and love and kindness as ways that we move in the world, and human values that are important to embody. And when we combine these four approaches, I feel like you hit every corner of a person, and then you're doing total well-being for them on the inside and on the outside.
How many kids actually go through the program?
Yes, we've had about 80,000 college students go through the program, but we do have an affiliate program starting at 8 years old for schools called SKY Schools. So it's also SKY for Schools. And they have just finished teaching 100,000 students. And we do start as young as third grade. And I find it so important. It's why I personally started teaching this. I started with fourth graders. And when I started with fourth graders in 2006, the principal told me that the fourth graders were stressed out about the statewide tests. And they did look stressed. And they were 9 years old. So having them do emotional intelligence and social connection and all the breathing techniques at their desk, it just worked wonders. This is so necessary in education. It's the missing piece in education, is if we're requiring them to use their minds all day, you have to teach them a way to take care of their mind, to clean the mind, to calm the stress in the nervous system. And only a calm and happy person can learn in the best way.
We'll take a short break for one of our awesome sponsors, Born Shoes. I was so excited to try these cute, casual sandals made with top quality leather, perfect for all the traveling that I do. They're so comfortable for walking anywhere. I know exactly why their tagline is, "Take comfort in Born Shoes." Perfect. There are 5 new styles this spring, and I tried Ithaca and absolutely love them. But they also have boots and heels you should try. They feel as good as they look. Go to bornshoes.com today for a 15% discount plus ground shipping on all full price shoes when you use my promo code UNTANGLE. That's promo code UNTANGLE for 15% off and free shipping. Available exclusively to our listeners for just a limited time. Now, back to our show.
Isn't that interesting? I mean, if you think about it, if anyone either listening or the two of you, if you've ever felt anxious, you've ever felt your heartbeat or you're sweating or you're ruminating on something that's making you very nervous, you can't think about anything else. So if you think about a child in school feeling anxious without having an outlet for that, it's so sad.
It really is. And especially when you look at the fact that it's so easy to teach children and young adults and older adults, and it's easy to learn and implement. But I think that some of the work that Annalise has done recently at Yale University actually demonstrated that people need to have a practice. And that you really can't just expect that everything's going to be fine unless you're making it fine. And you're having a practice is sort of the magic to that. It gives you what you need to be able to take on super difficult situations that we know are outside of our hands. And we can't change everything around us, but we can change how we're being inside of those situations.
That makes so much sense.
I've been impressed how much children and college students will do the practices once they've experienced some of the breath work
I've had 16-year-olds tell me they get up at 5 a.m. before high school just to do their practice because it makes them feel so good all day.
Wow.
And then just having taught in such a competitive environment like Yale, that Yale University students told me, nobody makes you a focus on your well-being. It's just not a priority. You almost laugh when they say, take care of your well-being. So they told me they came to my class to be forced to focus on their well-being. They were happy to be forced. And they actually, many of them started practicing daily, which was really impressive to me. And the results correlate. The more they practice, the more benefits they have with their well-being. And even just practicing twice a week in class had incredible well-being benefits. When many of them entered into my class, I gave a survey to find out where they're at with their mental health. And I was shocked to see that 50% of them said they had had suicidal thoughts in the past year. So I feel like this is the most urgent need in education right now.
I think it's the most urgent need outside of education too, because I mean, we've been talking a lot here about college students and high school students and even grade school students, but I think this is a huge problem with adults. I mean, you mentioned the at-risk groups like veterans, but I think there are so many people that live their daily lives with depression or anxiety. And the numbers, you probably have some statistics on the number of people who are actually on medication for either depression or anxiety. These are huge challenges. And I'm sort of curious how you each like sort of came to want to work in this area and to create these programs that are focused on well-being.
It's so funny. My husband and I left in 1989. We moved to Hong Kong, and I was actually a commodities trader. And I'd studied Chinese in undergrad and lived in China for a couple of years prior to moving there in 89. My husband's an architect, and we were both pretty successful professionally. And we had a son, and he was 2 years old. And my husband and I just kept looking at each other like, oh my God, what do we do now? What do we do now? And it was like, what do we do? How do we discipline? And that opened up the journey for me specifically with regard to children and how to be with young kids, my own in particular, and then others as it came along, to be able to support them staying connected to their inner voice and being authentically who they were within larger systems, whether it was our own family system or whether it was a larger school system or their peer groups, how to keep them safest was for them to know their inner voice. There was a sixth sense when they were in danger. There was something in them that would let them know when it wasn't right to be where they were. But often that is overridden by external voices that are very loud within family systems and within society that contribute to all of us becoming disconnected from ourselves. My own journey with my own kids, and that, you know, my son is now 24. So I've been doing this for like 20 something years, and it changed my life.
Well, what did you actually do? What did you actually do, Catherine? Because I feel like you just hit on something that is so important. We talked about being disconnected from other people and not belonging, but this disconnection from your inner voice,
yeah,
very serious also. So you saw how important that was, but talk a little bit about what you mean by your inner voice and what kinds of practices you did for yourself and with your family to try and kind of reconnect with that inner voice.
Sure. So way back then, what it started out with for us was really learning through what I call standing on the shoulders of giants. Some incredible people came into our lives. Thomas Gordon, who was nominated for the Nobel Peace Prize 3 times for his parent effectiveness training. Marshall Rosenberg, who was the founder of restorative justice in the U.S. prison systems and the founder of the Center for Nonviolent Communication. Eugene Gendland, who founded the Focusing Institute. And these were my teachers and my mentors, and I was lucky enough to study with them. And through that, learn about the external world and what happens out there as a catalyst, but not the cause of how I feel. And when we stop blaming the outside world as if it's what causes how I feel inside, then I stop trying to manipulate the externals. And I start to realize, oh, it's something inside of me that I need to be with rather than my focus on outside of me. Mm-hmm. And that's really contrary to everything that we learn. Like our entire world is set up on, oh, buy this beautiful car, you'll feel better. Oh, buy this, buy that, buy the other thing, go here, go there, do this, do that. It's all about something out there that's going to make me feel better. And the problem with that is that it's not true. No matter how many new things we buy or shiny baubles that we get or whatnot, it's all about, it's an inside job. Mm-hmm. And so teaching children from the beginning, you know, hey, it's disappointing when you don't get invited to the birthday party. And the thought about going out there and trying to make the whole world accommodate you so you feel better isn't the right approach. You can mourn your losses, as Marshall Rosenberg used to say, we mourn and we celebrate all on the same day. We mourn the ways in which our needs were not met. We celebrate the ways in which they were. So practices is what's important, right? And that idea of being able to speak out. People lose their voice. So the ability to speak from one's heart, even though other people may get triggered. This happens in families all the time. Children are to be seen and not heard. There's a huge societal matrix that exists around discriminating against children's needs being less important or valid. And it operates so pervasively that how do you support and give children the support that they need to stay in touch with their own voice in spite of the system's response to it?
I love what you're saying because I think it also helps. I mean, if you have a very strong inner voice that you are connected to, it helps with your security and confidence. And I think a lot of things come down to how confident you feel in your own shoes, because that external world and that external voice is so powerful. It's in
sage wisdom, isn't it? I mean, to thine own self be true. It goes way back to Shakespeare. I mean, how many of our great leaders, whether they were writers or spiritual leaders, they all say the same thing. It really is to thine own self be true, in spite of the external voices that tell you to deny it, betray it, to betray your own inner voice in order to keep some kind of external harmonious situation that's probably toxic. But there's risk. There are lots of risk. And, you know, it takes a lot of courage for people to stand up and be, it's a Rosa Parks moment, right? Yeah. You know, it takes a lot of oomph for people to be so clear about what's right in spite of the response that they may get from the world around them.
Well, and to your point, you really need the support of teachers and parents. And often it's teachers and parents that are pushing you towards the external world. So I think there is some way that, like you both are saying, really, that parents and teachers also need to be involved in this process where they're having such an impact on us.
Precisely.
And I love what you were saying about we mourn and celebrate all in one day, because I think that's a really, it's a complicated concept for people to grapple with, because we want to be celebrating more than we mourn. But the truth is we feel pain and joy in one day in our lives. And just really being able to feel that pain and learning that as a young child, that's like so important, that you don't have to push pain down or run away, but that you can mourn and feel that pain, but also celebrate and feel gratitude at the same time.
Because what we know is that in order for that pain to disappear, you have to actually recognize it and acknowledge it.
Yes.
So there are different expressions, name it to tame it. You have to name what you're experiencing in order to tame it. Again, Brené Brown talks about emotional granularity, that the more expansive our vocabulary and our capacity to actually say things specifically gives us a greater capacity to actually manage our emotional states of being. Mm-hmm. You know, focusing, they talk about being with and getting bigger than what's bugging you so that you can be with anything, but not merged with it.
Right.
When we merge with emotional states of being, we lose sense of who we really are. We become identified with something rather than being with something.
Yeah, I love the way you're talking about that. So I don't think you've mentioned this, but you have a conscious parenting program. And is that something that you did in Hong Kong and you're also doing in the US? Or tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, so when I mentioned my son was 2 years old, I started taking a parent effectiveness training class. I took it twice a year for 5 years.
Wow, your son is very lucky.
Because not because it's like conceptually it's easy to learn. It's not easy to implement because you actually have to really like your true north has to come through and you have to move through your own family of dysfunction. Mm-hmm. And I remember saying to my daughter, who then later came along, Pia, if I'd had these conversations with my mother when I was your age, it would have changed my life.
Right.
Like this level of honesty and authenticity that we can have as two human beings rather than a mother and a daughter, it would have changed my life. One of my favorite people is Alice Miller, and she wrote in The Drama of the Gifted Child, in her own childhood, if there had been just one enlightened witness, and it only takes one, someone who could have recognized the truth of what was a dysfunctional pattern and the cruelty of what that was, if they had just stood with her and seen it for what it was, it would have changed everything. So it's not like we have to have droves and droves of people. We just need one who can actually see clearly through all of it and speak the truth.
Well, and how many people can actually do that? I mean, we look at our parents, we look at a lot of the people we know. I mean, there are a lot of unconscious people walking around raising children. And a lot of conscious people too.
That's what fueled my whole passion just through my own like family of origin and wanting to be sure that my children didn't suffer from an unconscious parent. And so I think we have to recognize that there's no one to blame. Nobody to blame. My parents aren't to blame. They did the best they could, but they carried forward what I'm going to call transgenerational patterns of dysfunction. And I think it happens everywhere. And if we can break out of trying to make them wrong or bad and acknowledge they were doing the best that they could, although the harm is done.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Nobody intends it.
Yeah.
Harm is done. Our job isn't to look back and blame them. It's to just transcend it. And that really is roll your sleeves up and do a lot of inner work. And how do we do that? Well, we learn to be with what we're suffering from rather than merge with it. Mm. Right?
Well, say a little bit more about being with it versus merging with it.
When you have strong emotion, it's very easy for us to become caught up in the pain, at which point we're no longer presencing the pain. We're actually losing ourselves and thinking, I am the sorrow. I am this sadness. I am one of these emotional states, when that's not who I am, but I'm experiencing it. So when you start looking at the observer state, it's called by different names, by different, what I would call it, traditions.
Yes. Yeah.
And in the focusing world, we just say it's about getting bigger than what's bugging you and recognizing if I'm present and I'm self in presence, then I can actually be with whatever I'm going through without merging with it. It's actually untangling a mess inside. I love the name of your program. Because entangling and untangling, we recognize that knots are inside of us. And our ability to be with them without judging them as right or wrong, good or bad, shouldn't be there, any of that damaging inner critic self-talk. If we could just be present to it, then we can be with it just the way it is, with this sort of loving presence. Acknowledging it there, not denying it, because that certainly isn't going to help anything. But merging with it certainly isn't going to help anything either.
What are your, both of you, Annalise and Catherine, what are your practices? What are the practices that you personally do every day?
I entered into all of this as a professional ballet dancer, starting with yoga, like physical yoga. I was threatened by my physical therapist that I would never get rid of all my tendonitises without practicing physical yoga. So I do some of that. And then I tried all sorts of meditation. And what that led me to was learning Sudarshan Kriya through the Art of Living. But that was the one that clicked for me. I had tried all kinds of meditation in New York City. I was a lonely ballet dancer looking for getting rid of my stage anxiety. And the only kind that stuck with me is my neighbor in my building recommended, welcome to this Art of Living class. And I learned pranayama and Sudarshan Kriya through that class. Actually exactly 20 years ago. And I have never stopped practicing it daily for 20 years because I just find it so effective. And I feel so happy all day, no matter what comes my way, like more resilient. And I think what kind of proved that to me, quote unquote, in a real world way, is that I used to suffer from a lot of stage anxiety, stage fright, even after having danced professionally at that point for 8 years, I would be just like nervous to the pit of my stomach to go on stage and not feeling well the whole evening and that was my job at that point. Yeah. And after I started practicing the breathing techniques and meditating a bit afterwards, I remember walking onto stage one night, maybe after 2 or 3 weeks of the practice, and I suddenly felt no difference from standing in the wings and walking on the stage. And I looked and saw all those people and I didn't feel any, like no anxiety or tightness inside. It was just like I was in my living room with my family or something. And I thought that was the most remarkable thing, that whatever used to be so stressful for me suddenly became this easeful and joyful experience. That just made me stick with the practice. That day I was like, no matter what, I'm going to do this practice daily.
Yeah. What is the art of living?
Well, the art of living is a worldwide foundation that has the goal of creating a stress-free and violence-free society. But Art of Living believes that you can only create a stress-free, violence-free society by teaching individuals how to become stress-free from the inside out. And if each individual is empowered with those tools, then the society eventually becomes stress-free and violence-free. And I would say also the Art of Living is wanting to reduce all the barriers between people and create a sense of connection. So one of the missions is to create belongingness in every community where the Art of Living is established, is to break down walls, break down barriers, and create a sense of one world family, a family across the globe.
Catherine, what's your practice?
I just look back on my life and I really became connected to a spiritual path about 35 years ago. I was in graduate school and my older sister died. And it just really rattled me to find that bigger sense of truth so that I could make sense of this world and people coming and going. And I had such a limited perspective. So I think that started me down, you know, like A Course in Miracles. And then I think I did everything. I mean, literally, if you just took out the dictionary of possibilities, I think I did them all. And in the human transformation and the movement around just consciousness. But what really brought me to where I was or where I am now is that I needed something more of a practice. Mm-hmm. So it was much more intellectual. And so I literally stumbled into a resort in the Philippines about 5 years ago. And the founder of the Art of Living was there. His name is Sri Sri Ravi Shankar. And I was sitting in a clinic after some cleanse. And there was an Indian gentleman next to me. And I just struck up a conversation about, oh, I was just an Indian, blah, blah, blah. And he was like, oh my gosh, I'm here with Sri Sri Ravi Shankar, who I'd never heard of. But he said, come to our villa tonight for a meditation. And I was like, great, I'd love that. And it turned out that I was with one of the great humanitarian and world leaders on the planet. And I didn't even know it. And they were super excited and like, we'll teach you the Sudarshan Kriya. And I was like, great. Okay. So there I was with a few other people and they taught me this breathing practice and I fell in love with it.
So tell our audience what a Kriya is for those that don't know, because we've talked about breath practices and on our podcast, we talk about a lot of different types of meditation, and I don't think we've talked about Kriya here.
Yes, so Kriya means a purifying technique, and there's several kinds of Kriya. This particular type of Kriya that Sri Sri Ravi Shankar brought out in this lifetime is called Sudarshan Kriya. So Su is proper, and Darshan is vision, and Kriya is a purifying action. So this practice is said to be a purifying action through the breath. It gives you a proper vision of who you really are, a clear vision. So basically the breath work integrated into the practice takes you into a very deep state of meditation. So it's a combination of breath work and patterns in the breath that are very natural to the nervous system that clear out all the stresses on a cellular level. And then they allow the nervous system to sink into a deep state of meditation. So it's both breathwork and meditation. And it's such a beautiful practice.
Wow. So you're both working together on a Mental Health Summit in Denver, Colorado, which is coming up shortly, July 23rd and 4th this month. Can you talk a little bit about what you're doing with the summit, what you hope to accomplish? And I think it's really interesting that there are so many amazing speakers, but that they're so diverse. They come from politics, education, healthcare, from all these different areas, and you're kind of bringing people together. It's not a meditation conference, but there's a lot of well-being initiatives. Let's talk
about that. Yeah, I mean, you know, as I had mentioned, I've been in Hong Kong for 30 years. And in the fall of 2017, when my daughter started at USC, we started spending a bit more time in America again. And within, I think it was about 2 or 3 months, there was a message that went to the parent community that there was a suspected shooter on campus and that USC was going into lockdown. And I was absolutely mortified. And when that 3 hours that I was suffering, trying to figure out how my daughter was and what was going on, and there was a complete block on communication, I was so relieved that she was fine and everybody was fine, but I was shaken up. Right. And I think the fact that I'd been away for 30 years really had something to do with that. Like it was a culture shock. It was also, I hadn't been around for all those years of all those other shootings. And what I noticed around me was that there was a sense of numbness. I wouldn't call it complacency, but I would call it a sense of it's just the way it is. Not that anybody wants it to be that way, but almost like, what are we going to do about this? Like the problem seems so overwhelming. And I was just like, well, this can't be our new normal. Like, I don't know what happened to my country while I've been away, but this cannot be our new normal. And I'm going to be a stand for this not being our new normal. And with that in mind, I started traipsing around the planet to basically enroll someone else and then more to stand with me. And really the first person who like got it completely is Annalise. And she just got it instantly and was like, movement start on university campuses. And yes, this can't be our new normal. And you're right. Let's do something together. And with that kind of where the power of two happens, you know, and someone else sees and holds a vision with you, the world sort of unfolded. And now we have what I would say is a world-class lineup of thought leaders, influencers, change makers, people whose lives have been dedicated to mental health and well-being, who are coming together for us to create something collaboratively. Like, I know we need a broad base, and I know that people in silos are doing amazing work. My gut tells me that this has to be collaborative and we have to unify as a community, and that no matter whether we differ in politics or race or religion or whatever we might think we're different in this, we all come together. We share the same heart. We're all just so moved that we know that maybe what we haven't been able to do in our pods, we can do collaboratively. And so this is a broad-based coalition for all of us to come together to innovate. And with the spirit of a rising tide lifts all ships, to celebrate each other's work and find ways that we can become interconnected.
And is it focused primarily on, like, as we were talking about earlier, all of these different tools and techniques for well-being?
Yes.
For all of us.
Yeah, there are 4 main groups that we're focusing on. So it's education, healthcare providers, policymakers, and business.
Okay.
So we're really the leaders from these different groups, concerned citizens, family members, all of it's being held within a larger context of family and community, because how you grow up and the community you grow up in has such a deep impact on how you're being in the world and how you approach everything. What makes us distinct is that this is not just a healthcare provider's professional conference. It's not just a policymaker think tank. We're looking at practical solutions like breathing and meditation that are easy to implement across a wide spectrum. And we're bringing in all kinds. We wanted this to feel like a lot of people identify, like, oh yeah, I identify with Sister Jenna, or I identify with Rabbi Cooper, or I identify with various different inspirational leaders in the community. So it's about interfaith and recognizing, wow, maybe there's a role for faith in this conversation, and that is different.
It's not just spiritual and interfaith. That's one.
No, we have 2 presidential nominees coming.
Right, exactly.
Dr. Gracie Gaudette, who's head of 20 million veterans integrative medicine, coming. We've got business leaders coming. Ken Weil, who's one of our local Colorado heroes, who created social impact bonds as a way to finance building housing for the homeless and demonstrating that housing the homeless actually saves the state $60,000 per person per year. We've got Bill Milliken, the founder of Communities and Schools. 40 years ago, we're looking for creating something we don't have yet.
Right.
I'm excited, Patricia. I think you will be excited about this too, more and more to introduce meditation and breathwork as a very financially viable solution to the mental health crises in the U.S. If you introduce these practices upstream enough, they don't cost much. You can set people on their own line of doing the practice on their own, and they'll save a lot of money downstream. And also, we feel that breathing and meditation goes across all sectors. It can be practiced by students. It can be practiced by corporates. It can be practiced in healthcare, by doctors. We're really excited to introduce this more and more. In fact, we're closing the whole summit with a celebration in Denver City Park called America Meditates. And we're bringing the teacher that is so beloved by us, Sri Sri Ravi Shankar, from India to lead that huge meditation with 20,000 people. And we feel like the more we socialize the idea of the fact that anyone can benefit from meditation, the better off our mental health will be in this country.
Well, it sounds like it's going to be an amazing conference, and you have a lot of musical guests coming at the end of it, correct? After the meditation?
We do. So we feel really blessed because we have Milk, whose anthem, You Can't Keep Me Quiet, became the anthem of the Women's March. And she's such a powerful voice for that authenticity that I was talking about earlier, overcoming her family of origin to be able to be really authentic about actually my love is singing and performing, and her beautiful story about growing up as a Chinese American. And it's a great story about how she was able to just really overcome that family of origin pressure and be authentic to herself. We have Majesty coming, who's extraordinary, her beautiful voice. We've got MC Yogi. We've got a group coming from Argentina called So What. We're just going to rock in the park. We're going to have beautiful, we've got the Denver Children's Choir performing. It's going to be a summer
amazing. Yeah, it sounds beautiful. Well, I want to congratulate you both on pulling this all together. I think it's so needed, and issues around mental health and mental illness are just so, so critical. Yeah. So I'm glad that you're focusing on it. So is there anything else that you would like to add before we close?
I would direct people to the summit.americameditates.org page where they can see all of the different speakers that are coming and click on their bios and learn more about their backgrounds. They can see how they can join the summit. And it is 2 days. It is 23, 24. But when you buy your ticket for the summit, you will get an invitation which invites you to a full day training on Monday, the 22nd, where there'll be all these different tracks. Annalise will be leading a track for university students, teachers, educators, faculty members, healthcare providers who are so stressed out. They really need to learn how to take care of themselves so they can continue to be of service to the community. And I'll lead a track as well, which is going to be for more families and parents to really learn about how to support themselves and their children to transcend what's happening internally that's very difficult necessarily not to get merged with.
That's the training day is like a bonus day on July 22nd. And if people just want to come participate in the huge meditation in the park, they can get free tickets on americameditates.org. And there'll also be simultaneous meditations in 75 locations across the U.S. that will be joining through live stream. So of course, the best thing is to be in Denver.
As it turns out, I didn't know this when all of this hit me that it was so urgent, but this is the 20th anniversary of the Columbine High School shooting this year. I didn't know that at the time when I started just beating my little drum about we have to come together as a community and work with one another and join hands to cross the river. But it turns out this is a very important anniversary. So meditating on what it is that we can learn as a community, how we can actually set an example and be like a petri dish for the nation.
Catherine and Annalise, thank you so much for being on Untangle today. And we'll give some information again on how to reach out for the summit and for more information at the end of the show. So thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you so much, Patricia.
And we love your work.
Yes.
Thank you.
Thanks so much to Catherine and Annalise for being with us today. For more information on the program, that will be July 23rd and 24th in Denver, go to their website at summit.americameditates.org. And if you have suggestions for guests or any feedback for us, email us at founders@meditationstudioapp.com. And don't forget to check out Meditation Studio in the App Store and check out Muse at choosemuse.com. We'll see you next time.